This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Raslan, today we have BFM's very own Uma Pagan Ampake Pagan.
Hello, Cam.
Hello. And we have a first-timer. We've flown her all the way from Berlin, radio producer, and she's part of a cultural exchange here at BFM, Cora Knoblau.
Thanks for having me, Cam.
Great to have you here. And did I say your name correctly? Knoblau?
Yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah, do you know what it means, actually?
I think it means garlic.
Yes, it does mean garlic.
Yeah. That is fantastic. Yeah. I did not know that.
Yeah.
I like you more already.
It's a fruity name.
Yeah. And our three topics this week are, topic number one will be Hainanese chicken rice. Topic number two is, what do you pay for culture? Is 10 ringgit too much? And finally, topic number three will be the hijab. So, with topic number one, Hainanese chicken rice. I've had Hainanese chicken rice thousands of times. I like it. It's a very simple dish, almost boring. But the other day, I went to Ipoh, and I had it and tauge, bean sprouts, and it was delicious. It was amazing. It was like the first time I'd ever had it. And then I came back to KL, and somebody had posted a picture on social media about a recipe done by Waitrose, the British supermarket chain.
Well, it was a recipe done by a famous British chef, but advertised on Waitrose. So she was crafting the recipe for Waitrose's little, you know, they do these magazines and ads where they kind of advise people on, you know, here's a fascinating recipe for you to try out at home.
And this fascinating recipe was Hainanese chicken rice. But I saw the picture. I wish I could show it to you on Radioland. But it there's nothing remotely similar with the dish. It has, for instance, extra ingredients, lime zest, lime juice, chili, and honey.
But sounds good anyway.
You like the sound of that, dear Cora?
Yeah. Lime juice sounds good.
Yeah? But it's nothing to do with the dish.
But then what's wrong with putting it into the chicken dish?
Well, what indeed? I mean, you can put anything you want, but then it becomes not Hainanese chicken rice. It becomes
something else.
Waitrose.
Well, British Hainanese chicken rice, maybe.
Yeah? So you're okay with that then?
I don't know what's bothering you, actually, the picture, because it looks like another dish, or just this lime juice thing?
Everything. Look at it, Cora. Look at it.
It looks delicious. To me, it looks just like a German chicken rice dish we have.
Okay.
Does it? Does it?
Yes.
So here's the thing.
Hühner fricassee. It's chicken fricassee. It's a very traditional German rice chicken dish. Well, there is no pepperoni or chili or what is it?
Fricassee means fried, though. Yeah.
It's a French word, but it means that the pieces of the chicken are like mouth-sized.
Oh,
right.
The chicken is steamed.
Okay.
No spices.
Sounds similar.
Like a children nice dish. When you're sick and you're feeling low and you have a headache, you all want to eat it.
So here's where Cam is coming from. Tell me, Cora, what is a German dish that is sacrosanct for you guys in Germany? What is the one dish which is quintessentially German?
Two meat dishes, I would say. One is what the Americans called the hamburger, right? Because they met this meatball in Hamburg. Mm-hmm. We don't call it hamburger, it's a boulette. Or actually, every region in Germany has a different, maybe a little bit different name for it, but we serve it in all over Germany. It's like, yeah, what is it? A hamburger, you would call it. You serve it with mustard, no ketchup.
Right.
For kids, maybe, but no mustard.
Now, imagine we printed an ad in the newspaper here for this dish and added lime zest. That is how.
Disgusting.
Thank you.
Right.
That is how Cam is feeling right now.
I am indeed. No, but I was talking to somebody in the BFM office who is of Hainanese descent, and I was showing this to her, and she was going, oh, this is terrible, terrible. So I was mentioning to her about chicken chop. Now, chicken chop is a dish here which is about a quarter of a chicken.
Breaded.
Sometimes. And it's kind of like really flattened.
Flattened out.
Flattened out. There's a sauce on it, and then it comes with chips.
Oh, it sounds delicious too.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, it is. I was pointing out to her that there's no such thing as chicken chop in the West. Because she was asking, so what is chicken chop in the West? It's like, no such thing. No such thing exists. There's lamb chop. There's pork chop. There's no chicken chop. And so she'd always grown up thinking that it was a Western import, but it's unique to this country. So we're culturally appropriating all the time as well.
No, we are. And I don't think there is a problem with culturally appropriating or modifying food. So for example, when we take pizza, we maintain the core tenets of what a pizza is. Dough, tomato sauce if it's a red pizza, cheese, and then we throw everything else on top. So in Malaysia,
but not too much.
But on Malaysia, you have chicken rendang on top of the pizza. So we Malaysianize it. But the core tenets of what make a pizza remains the same. Now, if I replaced the tomatoes with beetroot, that would be a travesty, right? I mean, it would not be a pizza anymore if I put beetroot sauce instead. Then it's just bread with something on top.
But even for an Italian, if you throw some Indish, this Indian chicken on top of it, someone from Italy will not eat it.
No,
it's yeah,
not, probably no pizza not.
Anymore. And I'm with them.
You're with them. But no, I'm not with that, but I'm against this because they've broken what the core tenets of Hainanese chicken is. So when you're making Hainanese chicken rice, you got to boil the chicken whole. The chicken's usually cold when it's served to you. I mean, all of these things are what constitute the definition of what a Hainanese chicken rice is. But it can be other kinds. It can be Waitrose chicken rice.
Yeah, don't call it Hainanese. But Corey, you had chicken rice the other day because you knew we were going to talk about this. You went and had it.
Yesterday, and it was interesting because the chicken was fried. It was a deep fried chicken.
Yeah. So they have two kinds, right? They've got the...
Deep fried?
Oh, it was deep fried.
Yeah, it was crispy. And it was supposed to be a Malaysian place.
Yeah. What's going on?
I don't know where
so
you
So now
went.
I'm kind of confused because you're showing me this other thing. I didn't have Hainanese chicken then.
You didn't have any lemon zest.
It was just some kind of
I think after this we're going to have to take you for some proper Hainanese chicken
rice.
Yeah.
I want food.
So in conclusion, cultural appropriation.
For food?
Good thing. Right, unavoidable. Unavoidable.
But I think the good thing about it is that in this way we learn dishes, right? I mean, if it's pizza or a hamburger or some Indian chicken or whatever it is, although maybe it will not taste like it tastes like in the home country, but still I learn a little bit of it, right?
You're right, because a lot of countries, I guess, even Chinese food, when you eat Chinese food in India, it tastes very different from Chinese food here or what I imagine Chinese food tastes in China because it's kind of catered to the local palate.
Hmm. It's Cantonese food, basically.
Yeah, it's Cantonese food. And I think the problem is more often than not, Chinese food in India actually has spice to it. It tastes like, I can't describe it
other than
Indian Chinese food, right? Yeah. That's what it tastes like. But it's still made by Chinese people. And I think there are Chinese people who went to India and went, the local Indians aren't taking to my kind of dish, so I'm going to adapt it to the local market. I think the problem and the outrage with this one was because the recipe was crafted by a white person.
Yeah, and so but that's the point.
That's the point, right? And so people here are angry because they're like, oh, no, how dare you take our recipe?
So it would have been something else if a Malaysian chef I prepare you a Hainanese chicken the way a British person might like it, right?
And we could just simply denounce them as cultural traitors. and the job's done.
Okay, I got one more piece of controversy for you, Cam Razlan.
Okay.
The person who crafted that dish, there's an added layer of controversy. She is the partner of John Turode. He is the chef that wanted crispy rendang this year. Yes.
No.
Yes.
Oh. So we have to. I'll explain that
we'll
controversy
explain
to you
controversy later,
Cora. That's terrible. Well, their visa applications will be denied. So we move on. We move on, though, to topic number two. Uma, recently you did another edition of your Kuala Lumpur Festival.
I did.
And you had controversy.
Not controversy. I had annoyances. There was a bit of controversy regarding Lelaki Komunis Terakhir that we wanted to screen, but that's for another show. What I want to talk about is the sustainability of festivals. So 2018 edition of Kuala Lumpur Festival, Cora was there, she took part.
It was a nice festival.
Thank you so much. You attend every year, Cam. Mm-hmm. And here's the thing, for the first year in 6 years, we decided to charge an entry fee. And that's because we've always had trouble with sponsorships. Not that there isn't money, but we're very careful as to where we get our money from, if only because we want to maintain a certain level of independence. So the core sponsors every year, British Council, Goethe Institute, Japan Foundation, US Embassy, they've kind of helped us out. But they've always been very open-minded, and they've always gone, you know what, you craft your program, you talk about whatever you want, and that's great. We've had some corporate sponsors in the past, and touch wood, when we've dealt with these corporate sponsors, they've said the same thing to us. They're like, you know, we trust you, and we want these sorts of conversations to take place. And that's the main reason why, in the last 6 years, we've never taken any state money. We've never taken money from the government, because we thought that comes with a whole load of complications, right? And so we thought we're going to charge this year, because we wanted to see what that would be like. And we weren't charging much. It was 10 ringgit. 10 ringgit
It's like a coffee, right?
It's like a coffee. It's cappuccino. Less than a coffee here. 10 ringgit for all 3 days, right? The festival ran for a week, but those were early in the week. We just had workshops and stuff. But the core festival runs Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and there are events every hour across 3-4 different venues. And with your 10 ringgit pass, you can attend all of that stuff, with the exception of the workshops, which are like about $50. And the workshops feature internationally renowned and award-winning people teaching you about things like investigative journalism and yourself, giving workshops, talking about investigative journalism, talking about how to write science fiction, a whole bunch of stuff. You wouldn't believe the conversations I had over those 3 days were from people just going, why do I have to pay 10 ringgit? I mean, I only want to go to this one thing. I may not want to go to all of them. So do I still have to pay 10 bucks? I just want to go to one session. I'm like, yeah, it's 10 bucks, but you have an option. And the Frappuccino you're holding in your hand is more expensive. Some people have come up to me and gone, can I go inside for a little while and see if I like it? And then I will.
Seriously?
I'm not joking. And then I'll come out, and if I like it, I'll pay you the 10 bucks. And I'm like, do you go to a movie and see if you like it and then demand for your money back if you don't? Mm. Right? I mean, how does this work? And I'm not saying everyone was like that. There are a whole bunch of Malaysians who were really supportive, and they came up and they gave the 10 bucks. And some of them said, you know what? Some gave even more because they just said, I want to donate to the festival to keep it going. So we had lovely people like that as well. You know, this is at Publica. And these are people who come to Publica.
How many people are we talking about?
So I had at least 10 different conversations. And I actually wrote them all down because I was like, I need to make a note of all of this. And that was just me. My producer, Chingy, had her own set of conversations with people who were like complaining that 50 ringgit was too much for a 2-hour or 3-hour workshop. And so I don't know where that stems from. And I don't know whether Malaysians maybe don't see the value in paying that money for self-improvement. Sure, our workshops don't give you a certificate at the end of it. So, you know, you don't get something that you can show your boss and say, I went to learn something.
Mm,
but surely there's something to be said for that kind of self-improvement.
What about other festivals? Do they charge? Or are you like the only festival now charging? Or
so a lot of other festivals do it for free if it's a kind of literary or ideas type festival. I mean, we're the only ideas festival, but literature and that kind of stuff, where there are panel discussions, they're all kind of free. The only festivals that do charge, and they charge a significant amount more, are the music festivals. And it's weird because I think people see that, oh, an international music artist costs a lot of money, so we have to pay that. But international writers and journalists also cost money, and we have to fly them down too, but they don't see that connection.
So Georgetown Literary Festival
is free. It's except free. For the workshops.
Right, okay.
Uh-huh. Same thing. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Bernice has the same issue when it comes to people paying for workshops over there at Georgetown as well.
Really?
Yes.
Right, and okay. Well, you're always going to have cheapskates. You know, you're always going to have people who are pushing their luck. Everybody's always going to want to try and get it for free.
I guess.
But it's not
necessarily. Maybe they're spoiled then. That's you spoiled
exactly,
them.
Maybe so. I mean, Cora, I was going to ask you, the German public.
Yeah.
I know you guys in Germany, if I'm not mistaken, have a really big poetry festival, don't you?
Yes, but nothing is for free.
Nothing is for free, right?
You have to pay fees everywhere.
Like what? How much?
I don't know this poetry festival, what it's like, but
the reason I bring up poetry festival is because poetry is so niche. And from what I hear, even that gets tons of people going and they pay money to go.
Hmm.
It will be like the average fee for something like museum, going to a museum or whatever, will be like €8, maybe €10. That's like 35 to 48 ringgit.
Right.
Which is more than a coffee. It's probably like going to a movie, but without the popcorn, without the drinks, just to get into the movie.
Mm.
But people are used to it.
People are used to it. That's why I said spoiled. It's just, I mean, children go to a museum for free. Until the age of 18, you can go to any museum in Germany for free. But later on, you have to pay, even if it's just a reduced fee if you're jobless, for example. But people are used to paying. Of course, it keeps some people out, right?
I think people here are used to paying but feel very resentful that they're always having to pay. I mean,
right.
we have, you can't travel on a road without paying. Pay a toll on every single road, practically. And it's just like, it's just bang, it just one after the other. You've got to pay for this, pay for that. I think in Britain, right? In Britain, when I was growing up there, it's always been the case that going to museums is free. So it's free. But then they wanted to start charging. So they introduced a box at the front where you could put, and they suggested £5 or something. And people were very conflicted about that. It's like, yeah, but why pressure me to start paying and it's free? So I don't know how people didn't really go for it.
Also, I think there is this mentality that somehow we must be making money elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Mm. And because we're making money elsewhere, why do you need to charge us, right? And for me, it's a twofold thing. The reality is we're not making money elsewhere. And so we try to get whatever we can with regards to making this festival sustainable, right? So because every little helps. But on top of that, even if we were making money elsewhere, even if we did have sponsorship, surely there is something to be said about paying for something you see value in.
Yeah,
and maybe they don't see value in it.
Yeah, okay. Mm. So it's only a handful of people. Don't condemn everybody for...
I don't know.
It's a question of getting used to it, right? What I ask. I mean, if all the festivals are free and then your festival is charging something, of course people ask you, why are you charging something? Yeah. The other festival is for free. So maybe you have to talk to those other festivals. I mean, 10 ringgit, it's not a lot.
It's nothing,
and that's like a basic, it's a symbolic fee as well. Saying it's not somewhere you just walk in and out, oh, I'm boring, I step out. If you pay a fee, then it's a little bit a commitment as well. I'm attending here.
Correct.
I'm going to participate. I'm going to listen. Maybe I'm going to ask questions. And if it's for free, it's like a bazaar, you know? I go and see if I like something. If I don't like it, I go out or check my phone, and I'm not really attending it. Really.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we're not going to stop charging. We started now, and I think we do want to continue because we think it's important to charge, however nominal a fee it might be.
Yeah. Well, I think, producer Ali, we should have a conversation about charging for people listening to A Bit of Culture.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
10 ringgit?
I think we can really go for a premium. We want to get a good crowd. We want to get decent, you know, proper people.
You don't want my people.
Yeah, I don't want riffraff 10 ringgit people. Entry level kind of thing.
At least a frappuccino, not an Americano.
No, I'm talking Joe Low level kind of.
And if you're just listening for 5 minutes, then it's for free. And just if you listen maybe 15 minutes.
No, then. Flat rate.
Okay.
You got to have a yacht and a tiara. And
if
then
I
you
just
can listen.
Want to listen to one of those three, then...
Oh, okay, no. We'll start breaking it down.
You need a tiered system.
Producer Nali will work it out. So, but in a moment, in this, our final free episode of A Bit of Culture, we will be talking about the hijab here on Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Uma Pagan, Ampike Pagan, and Cora Knoblau.
Well done.
Oh, I said it. And now, topic number three, Cora. The hijab causes a bit of a controversy in Germany.
It's actually called the headscarf controversy, and it already has a fixed name in German. It's like really not a made-up name. It's really a name, the headscarf debate. It's going on for 20 years now, and it actually started to get really public attention when a young teacher, a woman, a Muslim woman, wanted to enter public school service, and she said she didn't want to take down her scarf. Mm. Entering school class. And at first the school said, no, it's not going to work. And then she went to court and the court said, yes, you cannot wear a headscarf because it's a religious symbol. And we have this policy of neutrality. And this debate is going on for more than 20 years now. And it's being captured by many layers. Of course, it's a multi-layer debate, right? It's not only about religious symbols. It's about politicians, about politics, about feminism, about Islam. But it's being captured by the right-wing parties as well. And to me, since I'm here now in Malaysia for the first time, and especially in Kuala Lumpur, I see many women wearing headscarf. Some don't, some a hijab, covers of all kinds of... there are all many ways to cover your hair, right? Yeah. And I wondered how you look at this debate. I mean, we cannot discuss whether it's good or bad to wear a headscarf, right? But we can look at the debate.
Sure. First of all, Uma and I are guys. We're men, and...
Last time I checked.
Yeah. And my background's Malay, so I have many people in my family who wear the headscarf. Mm. But if we look at the debate, I think in many ways, I think it's still a contested area, but so much of it is also settled, a settled debate, I'm going to guess here. But I'm kind of outside looking in. It's not like a conversation that's an everyday discussion, is it, Uma?
I think in certain circles it might be, and just not in ours. So yet again, I'm an outside observer looking in, and I see and I listen to the conversations that women are having about wearing the headscarf, especially Malay women and Muslim women, with regards to how they feel about it, when they should put it on, when they can take it off, if they can take it off. There's so much societal pressure here among certain groups for you to wear it.
We have the same discussion in Germany too, right? It's discussed not only from the outsiders, the Christian male men judging an Islamic woman.
But also within the...
Yeah, within the community as well. And it's interesting, just what you said, that there is a change a little bit of wearing the headscarf, that lately many young girls, urban girls, educated women, are putting on the headscarf, saying for them it's a symbol of freedom. So to the other ones, for example, we have Seyran Ateş, which is a very famous lawyer with Turkish background, who's really saying that's not the truth. This headscarf, since she's coming from that community, is not a symbol of freedom. The opposite. It's a symbol of subjection.
And so for me, that's really a geographical debate as well. And from someone who is coming from a community where the hijab or the headscarf has been used in that manner, they're going to feel that it is nothing but a tool of oppression. But I can see how someone growing up in Germany, with all of the different conversations going on in Germany, that somehow this is an instrument of their culture that they can cling to and say it is something different that sets me apart from the rest of you who are telling me what I can and cannot do.
I think also a lot of the, especially in Berlin, the Muslims there are of Turkish.
Yeah.
Turkish descent.
Afghanistan as well.
Mm-hmm. So with Turkey, if it's an extension of the historical debate within Turkey, when Kemal Atatürk banned the headscarf from anywhere, from public life and from public spaces. And there's been a virtual civil war going on within Turkey over this issue. And now Erdogan and Erdogan's wife, for instance, are, if not actively promoting, then certainly allowing it back into
public. They are promoting it a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
They actually do.
So, I mean, you have undercurrents of other cultural wars.
And actually it comes down to the question, are all cultures equal to you, to me?
Yeah. Are all cultures equal? Yeah.
I mean,
I don't want to become a member of Pashtun culture, for instance, Afghan culture. I don't want to be a member of that.
No.
And there are many issues in Pashtun culture which I find really difficult. But if they really insist...
But can you accept values of another culture if this culture is living close to you next door? That's a tricky one, because obviously you can say, yeah, of course I accept and tolerate everyone. But when it's coming down, for example, to women problems or women issues, for example, yeah, I do have my difficulties to accept the value that a woman is less worth than a man. That's where it stops for me, for example.
And I can see that. I think the idea of cultural acceptance and where you draw your line with your own principles as well, right? I mean, there's acceptance and then there's what you're willing to fight for the other person as well.
Right.
But what about from within, I guess, the same religion? A few years ago, I was in the US and I was doing some research on what it was like being Muslim in America. And I was asking Muslims in America about these very things, like, you know, your freedoms, what you can do, whether you're okay with women wearing the hijab or not, et cetera, et cetera. And it was for a radio program that we could never air because I think it was a little too controversial at the time and we couldn't air it on Malaysian radio. But everyone I spoke to, it really depended upon which background they were coming from. So the Pakistani and Indian Muslims in America were all professionals. They were all doctors and they had come to America as doctors. They had run away from their own countries, but they had come with a certain amount of professionalism. And their views on this were completely different from, say, the African-American Muslims. A lot of them were either, you know...
Elijah Muhammad disciples.
Exactly, Elijah Muhammad disciples, or some of the people I spoke to had found Islam when they were in prison. And then that in itself is very different from the Middle Eastern Muslims who came in. And each group looks down on the other group.
Yeah.
It's so funny, but they all had very different views on how women should pray in the mosque.
Mm.
And whether they should wear the hijab. And so within the culture as well, it was really complex.
I think you have to look at, yeah, there are many cultures within one seemingly monolithic culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also, I just want to repeat that I'm on the outside looking in here, that, you know, for a woman, a Malay woman, I think an awful lot of Malay women would have take issue with the notion that they are inferior in any way.
Yeah.
Perceptionally or in actual fact or whatever. I mean, Malay women are very strong, powerful creatures. And then another issue we haven't mentioned, God. I mean, if, you know, you're choosing to wear something which connects you to God, I mean, that's a very powerful thing. This is not a fashion item, but it can become one.
It can become
one. But it's man-made too.
I think therein lies the conflict, right? In the sense that how do we accept and where do we stop accepting someone's reasoning for doing what they're doing? So if someone comes up to me, and I guess as someone who buys into the liberal ideology, when someone comes up to me and goes, well, you know, it is my religion, it's my God that tells me to do this, I feel out of place telling them no. And yeah.
Yeah. And I, we come from a very multicultural society where, yeah, we have to be comfortable with. I mean, you have to, you know, just at ease with and not stepping on toes. But also, Cora, you're very much a child of the Enlightenment.
Of course.
Of course. And not to say that, you know, Enlightenment issues have not seeped into Malaysian life, but that's a particular journey. And maybe other cultures are going down different journeys. I mean, people are going down different routes.
Hmm.
I don't know. But finish off, though. You've been here for now a week or so, Cora. How do you feel now when you see people in the streets and everything with their headscarves and stuff? How does this compare to?
Well, I talked to a couple of women wearing headscarves, and without asking them, I asked them several things about where they're from, what they're doing, like a fashion designer, different women. And a couple of them just told me, without that I asked them, oh, I just married this Malay. Oh, that's why I'm wearing the hijab.
Mm.
But to me, they said it in a way like he could have asked them to wear high heels or to please don't paint your nails or whatever. It was just not, to me, it didn't seem to be like a really meaningful symbol, just but something you do.
And I think that's an interesting angle as well, in that exists too. Some people spend very little time thinking about it.
Hmm.
And it's just what you do.
Yeah.
I don't hold that against anyone. I mean, there are a lot of things I know that I do. For my family, I'm not particularly religious myself, but my parents are Hindu and they do a lot of ritual and believe in a lot of stuff. And I know there are some things I do just because they ask me to, because I'm like, well, I'll keep you happy. It doesn't hurt me. It doesn't hurt you. But if I do it, it'll keep you happy. If I don't do it, you'll be a bit sad. So I don't want you to be sad. So I'll just do it. I spend no time thinking about it. Right. But it is of no consequence to my life. And I think there are some people who do choose to don the headscarf. And do it out of that reason as well. It's not of any consequence to their life, or at least they don't believe that it is.
We must move on, though. But it's a fascinating topic, and I wish you could. I mean, I never have to make those decisions, those choices, so I don't really know exactly what's going on there. But we must move on, and we come to the final part of the show, the recommendations, where we recommend something that we think might be of interest. And so, producer Ali has been on to me that I've been recommending far too many Austro-Hungarian and war-related things. So,
as you do almost every week.
And despite that, this time we actually have an actual German here this time. I'm not allowed to. So I'm going to...
yes, go for it.
No, I've been doing it far too much. So I want to recommend a historian. I think he's actually at the university in Hawaii, but he's the best foremost historian of the Indo-Malay world, the trade routes in what is present-day Malaysia and Indonesia. And his name is Anthony Reed. Anthony Reed, R-E-I-D, Trade Networks in the Age of Commerce and everything. Through reading his work, I have understood that we cannot look at all these present-day nation-states and separate their histories from each other. That the trade networks and actually the histories are all intimately interlinked and the cultures have spread. And there are differences in culture. The very Aceh is a very different culture from just across the waters in, say, Perak. But it's fascinating to have this world built up. So that's my recommendation. The works of Anthony Reed. Uma.
All right, so I have 1.5 recommendations today. I'm going to cheat a little bit. My half recommendation is a book, but a very, very quick book. You can find it. I've seen it at Kinokuniya. That's where I bought it. It is Frankenstein, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, but as annotated for scientists. Mm-hmm. And other creators. That's what the book is called.
So, for scientists or by scientists?
For
scientists.
So, the annotations look into Frankenstein the Monster and the whole story, and it looks at it purely from a scientific perspective, and it's really, really cool. So, I love annotated editions of books because they get you inside the mind of the writer. And then this was something completely unique to me because it goes beyond. I've got annotated editions of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, but it was always about, you know, the modern Prometheus, the horror elements and all of that stuff, the literary elements of it. But this one was the first one that I've read that goes into the scientific side of it, which is very, very cool because many people credit her for writing the very first piece of science fiction, which is Frankenstein, right?
Well, she'd like ahead of her time. Did she like invent, did she medically and scientifically know things that...
No. Well, it doesn't go into like how accurate it is scientifically, but it goes into...
Well, this would never happen.
Well, no, it doesn't do that. It's not like Jurassic Park, you can't have dinosaurs. No, it doesn't do that. But it actually looks at it from a perspective of scientific writing, which is very, very cool. So that's my half recommendation. My full recommendation is a fun TV show, but given that we're speaking about feminism and hijabs and stuff, I thought it kind of fits. It is a TV show called The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Mm-hmm. And it is on Amazon Prime. And it is, I think, coming into the second season, it just won a whole bunch of Emmys. It's an Amazon Prime original, and it centers around Mrs. Maisel, who is this character. She's the perfect wife. You know, she went to university. As soon as she graduated, she got married to this nice Jewish boy, which is what her parents always wanted, all their families wanted. And in the first episode, he has a day job, but he always wants to be a stand-up comedian, and he's just rubbish, and he's a complete failure, and he decides to leave her because he's like, this is not what I want with my life. And she's like, what are you talking about? I've done everything to make it perfect. And that's where the story kicks off, and that's where the turn happens, because she gets drunk and she goes on stage and puts on this pitch perfect stand-up comedy performance. And essentially it's a show about this woman in the 1960s who decides that she's going to pursue stand-up comedy in a male-dominated scene, and it is hilarious. It is beautifully written. It's beautifully acted. It's by the same people who created the TV show Gilmore Girls. Mm-hmm. And if you're unfamiliar with that, basically all of the dialogue is like a mile a minute, and it is snappy and filled with pop culture references, and oh, it's so good. Bahir and I are absolutely, Bahir, my co-host and at the movies, hooked. We just like binge watching it.
This is not based on a true story.
No. It's not based on a true story.
Right.
No, it's just purely fictional, but just the characters and this idea, like, you know, it's addressing issues that are prevalent today, women in comedy, for example. But setting it in the 1960s is so perfect because you have all of these other strictures and chauvinistic familial strictures that exist in the 1960s, which is perfect fodder to tell this story.
So it's Mad Men Funny.
Mad Men Funny, no. Marvelous Mrs. Maisel is what it's called.
Okay, all right.
Mrs. Maisel.
Mrs. Maisel, yeah.
Okay, so Cora.
I brought you a book from Germany that is right now not translated in English, but will be. It's written by a young woman called Margarete Stokowski. She's has a Polish origin, but is German. She's just 32 years old, a pretty young feminist, kind of polemical woman. And this book, it's her first book. It's called Untenrum Frei, which it's a kind of a word play. It means belly downwards undressed or belly downwards liberated. So liberated from clothes and liberated from anything else. And it's actually not a book only for young girls, for young boys as well. And it's very funny, it's entertaining, and sometimes it's sad and shocking, it's everything. And what she's doing remarks on how those inequality of girls and boys is still in Germany very vivid. Mm-hmm. And she points out those little daily things where you can really tell how girls, like in commercials, for example, are still being told that their body is inadequate per se. And it's a really good book, and I think everyone should read it.
Okay, great. We have a recommendation in German, a German book in German.
On a bit of culture.
Oh, dream come true. What's it called again?
Untenrum frei means belly downwards liberated or undressed.
I think that they're probably going to choose an English title when it comes to it. But yeah. The woman's name is?
Margareta Stokowski.
Okay.
Stokowski.
Good, cool. good. Oh, great. Okay, so that brings us to the end of this week's show. Only remains for me now to thank special honored guest all the way from Germany, Berlin, Cora Knoblau.
Thank you so much for having me.
Pleasure. And Uma Pagan, I'm Kim Parkin.
Always a pleasure, Cam.
And myself, Cam Raslan. We'd like you to like our Facebook page. Every like gets a free entry to the next Bit of Culture.
Oh, I was going to say a Bit of Culture Festival.
Yeah, yeah. Free entry because I'm going to start charging at least several thousands from here on in. And thank you. And please join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.